Are you an excessive thinker that's enjoying the show as you grit your teeth and bang your head against the wall? Help us keep asking the questions that remind us that there's really no perfect day for an existential crisis. Support the podcast or explore sponsorship opportunities at www.allamericanypodcast.com.
Stars and stripes, dumpster fire vibe. Come on.
Hello, my amazing excessive thinkers. Welcome back to All American Why. I'm Michael Jonas, and today I want to talk about a question that's been living rent-free in my head for months. If one of Oregon's largest industries told the government it was under sustained structural strain, who would be trying to fix it? Manufacturing, there'd be emergency meetings. Agriculture, we'd have legislative hearings. Technology, someone would announce a task force before lunch. And you know everything else. We have committees, focus groups, and focus groups about committees. But nonprofit corporations, mostly we tell them to write another grant, maybe hold another gala, throw in a silent auction, maybe for good measure. The more I've thought about it, the stranger this sounds, but this is what's going on. Here's what I realized. We've spent decades in America building an incredible support system for businesses. Since 1953, we've had the Small Business Administration, Small Business Development Centers, SCORE Mentors, and then here we have Business Oregon, Prosper Portland, Innovation Hubs, Loan Programs, Workforce Development, Business Incubators, Chambers of Commerce, Networking Organizations, and Technical Assistance Providers. Yes, that's a lot of ecosystem support. The entire ecosystem support is basically saying that it exists around one belief: healthy businesses create healthy communities. As a nonprofit and business attorney, I completely agree with this. But why do we stop believing that when the business happens to be a nonprofit corporation? This question sent me down a rabbit hole I wasn't expecting, and honestly makes me want to bang my head against the wall like most things these days. The deeper I looked, the more I realized this episode isn't really about nonprofits. It's about infrastructure. It's about who we decide is worth investing in. And it's about one of the largest workforces in America that most people don't even realize exists. Before we go any further, I think we need to clear up one of the biggest misconceptions about nonprofits. We tend to talk about nonprofits as though they're fundamentally different from businesses. Legally, they aren't. They're corporations. A nonprofit corporation is simply another form of corporation recognized under state law. The biggest difference isn't how it operates, it's what happens if it earns a surplus. A for-profit corporation can distribute profits to owners or shareholders. A nonprofit reinvests those dollars back into its mission. When you understand that, a lot of our assumptions about nonprofits really stop making sense. You see, nonprofits hire employees, they make payroll, they negotiate leases, they sign contracts, they purchase insurance, they manage technology, they oversee budgets. They comply or have to with employment laws, they manage cybersecurity, and they manage risk. In other words, they run businesses. Actually, I'd argue they run some of the most complicated businesses in America. Along with everything every other business has to think about, nonprofit leaders also have to navigate IRS tax-exempt regulations, charitable registration requirements, board governance, conflict of interest policies, donor restrictions, grant compliance, public disclosure laws, reporting obligations, and fiduciary duties. Here in Oregon, nonprofits are also regulated by the Department of Justice Charitable Activities Section. Executive directors of nonprofits have one of the few jobs where you're expected to be a CEO, a fundraiser, an HR director, a compliance officer, a therapist, a motivational speaker, and maybe even a technology strategist. It's an extraordinary amount of responsibility. And that brings me back to the question. If nonprofit corporations face all the same business challenges as every other corporation, and often quite more, why don't we support them in the same way? When I first started asking that question, I assumed that I had missed something. Surely there had to be a nonprofit equivalent of the Small Business Administration at the federal level. Surely there had to be statewide technical assistance centers where nonprofit leaders could get help with governance, legal compliance, etc. At the federal level, we've spent more than 70 years building an incredible ecosystem to support entrepreneurs. The Small Business Administration. We have small business development centers, SCORE, loan programs, etc. In Oregon, we have Business Oregon. In Portland, we have Prosper Portland and a new small business office. And then we have tons of ecosystem supports like business chambers, Oregon Entrepreneurs Network, MISO, Accelerate, Livelihood Northwest. We have education, networking, mentorship, and technical assistance for for-profit companies. But I noticed we don't have the nonprofit equivalent at the city, state, or federal level. And that's when I realized something much bigger. This isn't some niche corner of our economy. We're talking about one of Oregon's largest industries. Depending on the data source, nonprofit organizations employ roughly 190,000 to 208,000 Oregonians. That's about one out of every 10 workers in our state works for a nonprofit. One out of every 10. There's also this statistic. More than 84% of Oregon hospitals are nonprofit hospitals. Healthcare and social assistance account for nearly two-thirds of nonprofit employment in Oregon. In many rural communities, nonprofit organizations are among the largest employers and economic anchors. They're not just simply filling gaps, they're holding whole communities together. The lack of support becomes even more striking when you look at how government now delivers public services. Housing assistance, behavioral health, food security, youth development, environmental restoration, domestic violence services, arts and culture, senior services. The government doesn't do these like they did before. They rely on nonprofits to administer everything from early childhood education and refugee resettlement to workforce development. I don't necessarily think that that's a bad thing. Nonprofits are often deeply rooted in the communities they serve. They can respond more quickly than government. They frequently earn trust where the government struggles. They know the community and they innovate. They adapt. They understand local needs. Sometimes, often most times, they're the best organization for the job. So it doesn't bother me that nonprofits are doing government or quasi-governmental roles. That's not what bothers me. What bothers me is that we built the delivery system, but we forgot to build the support system. Imagine telling a private company, we'd like you to provide an essential public service. We'll reimburse you eventually. The reporting requirements may change every few years. You'll need to comply with multiple layers of federal, state, local, and grant requirements. We'll expect you to measure outcomes, collect data, manage volunteers, oversee a governing board, raise additional private funding, and somehow innovate while keeping administrative costs low. And then we say, good luck. We don't do that for private companies. We do that for nonprofits who are doing crucial social services for our communities.
Like what you're hearing? Back it, build it, be part of it. Support the show or sponsor an episode at www.allamericanwhypodcast.com. And thank you for thinking with us.
That's why I get a little frustrated when someone says nonprofits should just run themselves more like businesses. I've probably talked as many people out of forming a nonprofit as I have helped with forming them. Many organizations should be having difficult conversations about not forming as a nonprofit and doing some other social enterprise or business for good model, about narrowing their mission, about consolidating, about partnering, or even about dissolving if another organization's already doing the work more efficiently. But that's a governance conversation. That's not a support conversation. The reality is that most businesses aren't expected to generate private donations to subsidize public contracts. Businesses that are for-profit are not expected to educate volunteer boards on fiduciary duties while also navigating IRS regulations. If we've quietly built one of the nation's most important public workforces on the backs of nonprofit corporations, then we owe it to these organizations and to the communities that they serve to ask whether we've given them the support that they need to succeed. We also owe it to the people doing the work to support them with more than thank yous. They deserve sustainable careers and fair compensation. One of my favorite questions to ask is, if this organization disappeared tomorrow, what would happen? Sometimes the answer is surprisingly little. Sometimes another organization could step up. But sometimes the answer is devastating. Or when I ask this question, people stare at me. They don't have the answer. Because the reality is, if that organization was not funded or couldn't survive, meals would not be delivered. Children would lose out on after-school programs. Families would lose housing assistance. Survivors would lose advocacy services. Behavioral health appointments would disappear. Food pantries would close. Entire communities would feel the impact. We don't usually notice these organizations because they're quietly doing their jobs every single day. We surely notice them when they're gone, and we will continue to notice them when they're gone. If the consequences of failure are that significant, shouldn't we care just as much about preventing failure as we do about responding to it? That's what economic development is really about. It's not just helping businesses grow. It's helping essential institutions remain strong enough to continue serving the people who depend on them most. Once I started thinking about nonprofit organizations that way, another question naturally followed. If we've spent more than 70 years building an ecosystem support around small businesses, what would it look like if we finally decided to build one around nonprofit businesses as well? What if Oregon created nonprofit capacity centers modeled after our small business development centers? Imagine an executive director being able to sit down with someone and ask, "Our board is struggling with governance. Where do we start?" Or, "We're negotiating our first major government contract." Or, "The IRS sent us this letter." Or, "We had a cybersecurity incident. What do we do?" Or, "Our founder is retiring after 25 years. We don't know what succession looks like." There are plenty of organizations like Nonprofit Association of Oregon and People's Nonprofit Accelerator who help out with these things, but from an educational perspective, they don't do technical assistance programs, which are needed. The more I looked into it, the more convinced I became that we haven't ignored nonprofits because we don't care. We've ignored them because we've never really thought of them this way before. We've thought of them as charities. We've thought of them as service providers. We've thought of them as grant recipients. What we haven't consistently thought of them as is one of the most important business sectors in our state. Once you start seeing nonprofit corporations that way, it's hard to unsee. That's why I wanted to have this conversation with Scott Kerman. Scott has led nonprofit organizations, served in public leadership, and has spent decades watching these systems evolve from the inside. He's seen what works, what doesn't, and what happens when good organizations don't have the support that they need. Maybe I'm seeing something real. Maybe I'm missing an important piece of the story. Either way, I can't think of anyone better to explore that question with. Scott, welcome to All American Wine.
I think that was our minutes ago.
Yeah. Well, hi, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Michael. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for doing this podcast.
Yeah, I appreciate being invited. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. So on All American Why, you know, we're asking questions about America and things that are either wrong or not right or surprising. And I thought you'd be really good to talk to about nonprofits and nonprofit support in America.
We'll find out. There's certainly a lot to talk about. I think it's a good topic, and I think it's a very relevant topic this year, especially.
Yeah, absolutely. So just so listeners know, can you talk about your experience in the nonprofit sector and Where you were and where you're going.
Yeah, you know, my experience, it was a long, strange road to get there. I started out very much like you, an attorney. I was a criminal defense attorney, and that's what I thought I wanted to be my whole life, until I realized what I really wanted to be was a classroom teacher. And so I stopped practicing law. I got into teaching middle school, high school, eventually worked my way into school leadership at independent schools. And those are nonprofits, and got a lot of experience, learned a lot about nonprofits and running nonprofits and all the unique characteristics that are a part of being in a nonprofit. And that eventually led me to Blanchet House and Farm here in Portland, Oregon, a homeless services agency located in Old Town. I was there for about 6 years. And now I guess I'm a free agent. I'm working on a couple of things. I just finished an interim executive director gig at Share of Vancouver, which is it's really Southwest Washington's largest homeless service provider. It was a different experience in Blanchet House, which was, you know, much smaller, independently funded. Share is a massive organization that is involved in all kinds of homeless services, and for the most part, public funded. I'm also working with some people on a project right now to try to pilot something called a nonprofit consortium, and perhaps this is something that we'll talk about during this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you for doing great community work. I don't think it gets said enough. And, you know, nonprofit work is not for the faint of heart, especially nonprofit work that relates to hunger, houselessness, mm-hmm. mental health.
Well, but it is extraordinarily rewarding. I mean, and I say that with you know, I'm not just trying to blow smoke on that. I mean, it really is a wonderful way to earn a living, to spend your time, to have a career. Like I said, I started out, you know, trying to be a fee-based professional, and it just wasn't for me. It just didn't fill my cup the way working in other spaces did. So, working in nonprofit is extremely difficult and challenging. The work that you do, depending on what your nonprofit is serving, can be very traumatic and tragic and heartbreaking. But, you know, I'd rather do that than sell shoes, I suppose. You know, it's just something that really always motivated me, inspired me, made me want to do better.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about all the people who used to sell things. People sell shoes and vacuums and knives, yeah. Store to door.
And there's nothing wrong with selling shoes, by the way, especially here in Portland, Oregon. So yeah. I don't want to get hate mail. But, you know, I think you have to find something that drives your passion. Nonprofit work isn't for everyone, or I think for a lot of people, it is something that they want to do. And unfortunately, we're just experiencing a lot of burnout in the sector. And perhaps that's a good question that we can ask ourselves, you know, why is that?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things I really wanted to talk to you about was how the public sees nonprofits. So they sort of want it all, but then they don't provide the necessary support systems. Can you talk more about that?
Well, nonprofits, they hold a very uncertain space in our society. You know, they're kind of a corporation, but they're not a corporation. I mean, legally they're a corporation, of course, but I mean, nobody really cares about that. They think of them as a charity, and ascribe then all the things that they associate with charities. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're experiencing so much burnout and struggle in the nonprofit sector is there are expectations that don't match the reality of the work. And really the fact that nonprofits, although they are a beneficial corporation to some extent, exist in the same world as all other businesses and corporations, and have to play by most mm-hmm. of the same rules, but just have fewer tools to work with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a good point. I mean, they have intellectual property, they hire, they're caring about cybersecurity, I mean, all of the things are the same. So
human resources, bills that have to be paid, payroll that has to be processed. You know, I've had people over my career, you know, ask me the most extraordinary questions, you know, like, you know, wait, you have to pay your electric bill? You don't get that for free? No, we don't get a PGE discount for being a nonprofit. We pay for our electricity. We pay for the fuel that we put in our delivery or pickup vans. We pay payroll taxes. We are very much identical to Starbucks, McMenamins, Target, Nike, in many significant ways. And I think that surprises people.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, they're both corporations, as you said. One has stockholder distributions or dividends. The other is, if you raise money, you can do more for that charitable purpose. Right. One thing I talk about a lot is, you know, we have these organizations who are doing sometimes social services. They're doing things in the community that we care about. So we want them to be really good at that service. Then you add on top of that, that they may or may not have business experience. And then you had on top of that, that they have to understand nonprofit compliance, both at the state level and the federal level. And then we have, of course, the political environment that we're in. So you take already burnt out people doing multiple roles who don't have those supports, but then you add on the political environment and you add on a lack of funding. So I guess give us sort of your take on where things are at right now and how important it is to care and to support these organizations.
That is a meaty question.
It's
an important question too. So I appreciate you, you know, starting off with this. One of the things to keep in mind, especially in terms of social services, is that, you know, this is a civic responsibility to care for the citizens, the residents of our community, the people who live here, the people who are struggling to be housed, to have the proper clothing, to have the income that they need to survive, lack of food, medical care, what have you. But what, for the most part, what we see in our society is that this work to serve these people has been subcontracted out, to nonprofits, but not always with the tools that they need to actually do that work. So there's no secret that one of the struggles that nonprofits face is that the funding that they're receiving, if they're receiving funding at all from the county or the city or the state or what have you, is not sufficient to actually pay for the services that they're expected to provide. Some of that is just a byproduct of the limitation of budget. Some of it is the expectation that nonprofits should, you know, basically there's a starvation mentality that is ascribed to nonprofits, that you should be able to do this work with the thinnest possible margins and no overhead. This funding is not necessarily responsive to the realities. And so where you see a lot of change in our communities, you know, think about the last 5 years, the mental health crisis that has really skyrocketed, P2P meth, amphetamine, you know, sort of the super meth hitting the streets, the fentanyl crisis, you know, that increases the costs. Inflation, right? If in your own home, the cost to live has gone up. You go to the grocery store, you go to the gas station, what have you, and things are costing more than they used to. Well, they're also costing more for nonprofits. But unlike a business, a nonprofit can't just raise their prices in order to you know, pay for the things that they need in order to operate. They're still playing with the same pot of money that was approved maybe 1 or 2 years prior. So it's very much doing some of the most difficult work in our communities with both hands tied behind your back.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. And then the other thing is there's a lot of organizations who their primary funding was government. And if government can no longer fund them, I guess they have to create a development plan or do a fundraiser very quickly. Can you speak to that in terms of how organizations rely on funding and how if the funding gets pulled, you know, you may or may not have a notice or a plan.
Well, for a nonprofit, you know, obviously they need money to do their work, whether, you know, to pay the electric bill, to pay the insurance, to pay their employees, to purchase the supplies. I mean, this is, these are, you know, often $1 million and multi-million dollar operations, depending on the work that the nonprofit is doing. And they're doing that primarily with a single revenue source, and that is donations. Whether the donation, the grant is coming from the government or coming from a private foundation or coming from fundraising, there aren't really other sources of revenue. You're not selling anything. You're not marketing anything. You don't necessarily have anything of value. And while there's always a lot of advice out there, especially on LinkedIn, you know, nonprofits, you've got to develop, you know, multiple revenue streams. It's easier said than done. You know, what does that mean? Did you open up a thrift store? You start a small business? You know, how many thrift stores, you know, does one community need? How does a nonprofit that maybe is focused on feeding people or providing mental health services suddenly start up a small business that's going to make a profit, and a profit that is going to help fund the nonprofit services for which they needed to open up the small business? So you can kind of see that it's Alice in Wonderland. You just get deeper and deeper into the rabbit hole. And so you really are, for the most part, stuck with, you know, one type of revenue. You're not going to get venture capital, you know, infusion of funds. You can't sell shares of stock. You have to survive on donations. And you're absolutely correct. For nonprofits that might have been depending on public funding to the tune of 60% or more of their revenue, they're finding themselves in a real predicament right now, because that funding is not there the way that it used to be, especially if they were benefiting from federal funding. Mm-hmm. There are many organizations throughout Oregon that primarily survived on federal funding or passed through federal funding and weren't even in the business of doing independent fundraising, didn't have a history of going to the foundations in the state that provide funding for a lot of the nonprofits. And so they are now forced to get into that space as well, which means that the competition, and we hate to use that word competition, but you are, in a sense, vying for finite resources along with lots of other worthy organizations. So it is, to some extent, a competition. That field is getting much more crowded, and you're going to see a lot of nonprofits who used to bank on getting grants are going to find themselves coming up short.
Mm-hmm. And just so people who are listening who don't know, can you talk a little bit about restricted and unrestricted funds? Because I also feel like people get the sense of, we have money in, we can use that money for anything.
Right. Well, yeah. So let's think of it this way, because this can get kind of wonky. So if you go to Starbucks, we'll use Starbucks. You go to Starbucks and you buy your coffee, and the coffee is, you know, $4.50. You can't say to Starbucks, by the way, I want my $4.50 to go towards employee benefits. Mm-hmm. I'm restricting this payment to employee benefits because that's what really inspires me. I don't want to pay for your utility bills or your insurance or anything like that.
Or your labor union.
You can't do that, right? You know, in a sense, it's unrestricted payment. Starbucks can do whatever it wants with that $4.50. In the nonprofit world, if you're getting public funding, if you're contracted to provide a service and the county or the city or the state are paying you for that, then that funding is restricted. You can only use it in furtherance of fulfilling that contract. Why can that be a problem? Well, let's say the contract really only pays for 60 to 70% of your true operating costs for that service. Well, where does the other 30% come from? Maybe you can cobble together other grants, other restricted funding, and you can equal, 100% of that cost, but that's pretty difficult to do. And so you need unrestricted funding that you can use for whatever reason you need it to be used. It's hard to get unrestricted funding. I mean, for the most part, grants and public funding are going to be restricted. Mm-hmm. There may be a very specifically defined uses of that funding that can really put yourself in a box that makes it difficult sometimes to even spend the money. And to get the unrestricted funding, that's hustling out there. That's trying to inspire people to give without restriction to your organization so that you can use it for whatever purposes that you need. If you think about your typical nonprofit, their payroll, their people cost. So that's payroll taxes, benefits, retirement match, all of that is probably about 60 to 65% of their budget. So the rest of that budget for everything else, that's, let's say that's about 35%. The top items, chances are going to be your insurance, your utilities, maybe your repairs and maintenance if you're operating, a 4 or 5 story housing building with a commercial kitchen like we were doing at Blanchet House. Those are very difficult to fundraise for. Mm-hmm. Right. Your utility bill could run you 6 figures, gas, electricity, garbage, recycling, water, sewage, really sexy things.
Yeah. I was gonna say, you don't really see a fundraiser.
It's hard to do a fundraiser for that. And there are no grants for that. I remember, once I was talking to, I was actually talking to Governor Kotek and the governor asked if you could wish for something, what would you wish for? And I said, I'd wish that, for $500,000 that, the county or somebody would, somebody would give us $500,000. And the governor said, well, what would you do with that? And I'm like, well, right off the top, that would pay for the year's insurance, utilities, and repairs and maintenance. And I would still have quite a bit left over that I could use any way that I wanted. You could raise wages. You could invest in a technology upgrade. Like the idea that I could have that money to put forward any way that the organization could really benefit from. Mm-hmm. But the thought of like, wow, I've just taken care of some of my highest expenses. And now everything else I fundraise pays for the meat and potatoes, the services that, the reason that we're in this game. Mm-hmm. And I think people don't appreciate the burden of of things like insurance and utilities and repairs and all the things that we take for granted that Starbucks and Target and Nike are going to have to pay for. There's this image, I think, that nonprofits kind of exist in their own metaverse where sure. None of those things apply.
Well, and you've said a lot of corporations, which is fine, large corporations. There's also small businesses, and we live in a small business community, but small businesses have tons of resources. They have 90 business working programs. I had a conversation with the governor recently, mm-hmm. but it was for a moment. I think it might've been at the same event that I saw you at last. She thought that a lot of the nonprofit organizations that do business support services, like Accelerate Women and OEN and MISO, that they provided technical assistance to nonprofits as well. And I said, no, they don't. They don't. So, you know, not only do we not have the Small Business Administration and SBDCs, because those are all for for-profit businesses, we have a sea of for-profit ecosystem businesses or organizations. So I guess talk to me about, you know, could it potentially be that there are either Prosper Portland or Business Oregon programs that either are existing that open up to nonprofits as well, or potentially looking at those programs and saying, you know, we have funding that we can, especially in 2026, push towards nonprofit stabilization.
Well, yes. So what you've hit upon is that nonprofits are existing in the same universe as businesses and corporations, subject to most of the same rules and expectations, but they don't always have the expertise, the knowledge and experience to work within that universe. I mean, nobody starts a nonprofit because they love HR, you know, because they really dig, you know, payroll processing and compliance. They want to feed people. They want to clothe people. They want to educate people. They want to get, you know, young, you know, girls excited about science, or they want to help, you know, people with disabilities have experiences that they might not be able to have. And they take all that energy and they start a nonprofit and, you know, maybe it starts small and it catches fire because they're doing great work and people are inspired. And so they get bigger and they can do more things. And then suddenly things get complex because they didn't used to have payroll, but now they have payroll, which means they also have HR. They didn't used to have a lot of bills to process, and now they do. And now they have to be thinking about their cash flow. But that's not why they got into this work. Mm-hmm. That wasn't their interest. They may not have any experience, aptitude. There are a lot of people in nonprofit who don't want to do anything, have anything to do with money and finances, because they feel very insecure about their ability to work within that in that realm. And you can, you know, find yourself making some very expensive mistakes just from being naive, not really having a sense of what the rules are. And then I think to some extent there's a deliberate ignorance, a belief that is more pervasive than I would like in nonprofits, that maybe the rules don't apply. So for instance, someone who works at a nonprofit is protected by the same employment laws, wage and hour laws, as any other employee in the state of Oregon, which means if they're not exempt, right? And we could talk about that. You know, what does that mean? But they, you know, a 40-hour week, and if they work more than 40 hours, then they earn overtime. And you can't volunteer, right? You can't, someone who works at a nonprofit can't volunteer their time. But that happens a lot. And again, let's go back to Starbucks. I think if I was to say, oh, I heard Starbucks is asking their employees to volunteer their time to work on Saturdays, people would say that's absurd. They can't do that. And nor would Starbucks do that because they understand the rules. But in a nonprofit, there's this sense sometimes that those rules don't necessarily apply, that we're different. Well, we're not different in that respect. And I've always felt very strongly that these are laws that are designed to protect employees. These are the kinds of things that a nonprofit, a values-driven nonprofit, should want to be knowledgeable about and uphold. And so, you know, do I think people are making mistakes because they're intentionally negligent, or they're trying to get one over on their employees? No, I just think that there is a lack of information, a lack of knowledge. And even if someone was interested in learning more, are probably unsure where they could go to get that information, or if they would have to pay for it, then they wouldn't have the money. I mean, you're very generous with your pro bono time in terms of providing, you know, a lot of information and education to nonprofits. But, you know, I think that's pretty rare in the space. And not everybody, you know, knows who you are, and you're also a small business person, so you can't give away all of your time and all of your expertise. So we do need to create some structures in our community that nonprofit can access the information that they need when they need it.
Your support turns big questions into real episodes and big values into real action.
And wouldn't you agree too that if the nonprofit is using public funds, that in order for them to be a good steward of public funds, but for us to encourage good public fund stewardship, that it's actually the opposite, that they should potentially have more support than for-profit businesses? Because in a time when we don't have a lot of public funding, or we're sort of arguing, you know, it's parks or police or it's this or it's that, every bit of money that we have should go to organizations that have the tools that they need to fulfill. So if what you're saying, which I know this, I'm getting to a question, but like, if what you're saying is that these are folks who are amazing at their service, they don't necessarily know business, they also don't necessarily know nonprofit compliance, and they may or may not reach out when they need help, or they don't know who to go to, they're managing public funds for community programs. So in my mind, they should potentially have even more support. Do you agree with that? Or
absolutely. And the question I ask myself is, wouldn't the county or the city or whoever is providing the funding have the infrastructure, in a sense, to loan to the nonprofits, the back office, so to speak? You know, what would prevent the city of Portland or Metro or Multnomah County from being the back office, so to speak, of these organizations that they're funding, especially if they're smaller organizations? And often it's the smaller, newer organizations that are taking on these projects because they have the capacity that comes with, you know, sort of being small and not already overextended. It sounds like a paradox, but that's often how, I mean, it's larger organizations who are like, oh no, we can't take that on. They may actually be the in the better position to succeed, but it's like, yeah, that's too much. The water is already overlapping the pool.
You know, we have, as of early 2025 in Portland, through Prosper Portland, we have the Office of Small Business. We don't have an Office of Nonprofits or Office of Community Programs. And then we have Business Oregon. Business Oregon doesn't open up Business Oregon processes to nonprofits in the same way. Of course, there's restrictions. They can't open all the things. But I guess, why is that the case? Like, is it the assumption that the nonprofits will be okay, that they have what they need? I'm trying to figure out, like, why wouldn't either electeds or people making those decisions go like, hey, we're really not, we're a city or county, and we're contracting with nonprofits for social services that we don't do anymore. Why don't we have an office of nonprofits?
Right. Well, it's often said the answer to all of your questions is money, right? Mm-hmm. So what's funding these small business development centers and these business councils and chain, right? These are being funded through business, for business. The business community is investing in itself. Okay. So how does the nonprofit community sort of invest in themselves? And remember, nonprofits can't lobby. Well, they can, but generally, you know, there are pretty significant limits on lobbying, and it's an interesting feature of how nonprofits have been structured, because I mean, as we know, corporations are people too.
Yeah, right? I was gonna say, isn't it just a larger American problem of tying corporate greed to moral imperatives?
Yeah, that is certainly part of it, and I think there's this sort of the sainthood tax that comes on nonprofits, right? That because it's a charitable endeavor, you shouldn't be making any money. You know, and people would say, you know, you know, to me, you shouldn't be taking a salary at all. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I still have, you know, I have a mortgage and groceries and health and all of that. You know, I should be paid for my work. People who work at nonprofits should be paid, and they should be paid a living wage. There shouldn't be a sainthood tax because they work for a nonprofit.
The person who told you that, are they a trust fund baby?
No. I mean, you just hear this. You hear this generally, and yeah. I think that this is going to resonate with people doing this work who have probably heard the same thing, or just might be surprised. You know, like you're in the priesthood.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
And it's, you know, you've taken a vow of poverty, and it's like, no, I'm working for an entity that is providing vital social services that are filling gaps that our civil structures and systems aren't filling, right? You know, this is not really even optional work. So it's this idea that nonprofits exist in this sacred space where they are immunized from all of the different expectations and pressures that small business people and entrepreneurs, and I'm glad you brought up, you know, small business, you know, people, because, you know, they struggle too. They don't necessarily have all the levers to pull as, you know, let's say a large corporation can, you know, in order to make sure that they're making their revenue. They, you know, can charge more fees. You know, they can raise their fees, I suppose, and hope that they don't lose business. They can, you know, take on more clients because, you know, who needs to sleep? And maybe you work Saturdays. I mean,
they could get an SBA loan.
You can get an SBA loan, perhaps. You can go into debt. And I think one of the things, you know, we often talk about in terms of it's, you know, nonprofit doesn't mean you're not supposed to make a profit. It's really shorthand for not for profit. The idea is that a nonprofit does not exist in order to make a profit. Starbucks exists to make a profit, to sell good coffee, but also to make a profit, right?
Their coffee leaves
I'm not trying to pick on them. They just seem to be the business that's in my head right now. But for a nonprofit, you're mission oriented. You know, that means you're doing it in order to serve a mission, not to make a profit. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't make a profit. In fact, a stable nonprofit is going to have reserves. They're not going to be ending the year, you know, with $0 in the bank, and then raise all the money again for the following year. There should be profits that you can then invest in yourself, invest in your workforce, invest in your services, invest in your infrastructure. But of course, you know, nonprofits are supposed to exist without any overhead, unlike any other entity in the world.
What happens or will happen when organizations who are doing, I guess we could call quasi-governmental work, can no longer do it? They lose the government funding. They can't quickly raise tons of money to replace it. I've tried to ask people this, and there's a lot of like, well, they'll just figure it out, or they'll raise the money. So I guess I'm asking you, I mean, I already know the answer, but I'm asking you from a real sense of doing this work, that if an organization who's been contracting with the county for 15, 20 years, if they go under as a nonprofit, like who does that service or services that they have been doing for 15 or 20 years?
Well, no one, right? I mean, who's going to step in to fill that kind of gap? Some of the gap will be filled. Let's take our largest social service nonprofit in the community, I think is Central City Concern. Mm-hmm. Housing, healthcare. They do a lot of really important critical work throughout the community in different social sectors. If the bottom fell out at Central City Concern and they could no longer operate, how would we ever fill that gap? Who would step in to operate those health clinics? Other healthcare providers? That's a sector that's in trouble itself. Who's going to step in to operate all of the different housing and shelter? And so, and sometimes, you know, people can be really cynical and it's like, well, you know, all these nonprofits is just a grift and they should all fail. Mm. I don't think we would like to see that happen. I mean, number one, it's not a grift. But the failure of the nonprofit goes away, the problem still remains. Right. That this was, you know, the criticism sometimes is that if this shelter wasn't here, or if this food pantry wasn't here, then this problem wouldn't be here. Mm. As if that the only reason that there are hungry people or homeless people is because there is a shelter. Well, that's backwards thinking. The shelter is there because there are people there who need shelter. Mm. If you were to close down the shelter, the people are going to remain, or they're going to, you know, sort of move into other neighborhoods, mm-hmm. but they're not going to suddenly disappear or suddenly mm-hmm. be housed.
Well, when we want people who are familiar with that nonprofit purpose to be working on the issues. And so sometimes an organization will be, a pillar of the community. They know the ebbs and flows of that service. They know the people. So there is this sort of thing sometimes where people are like, well, just let the nonprofit fail and there will be another one. Or if they can't survive, that's on them. So what's your thought on that, of like the argument that if a nonprofit can't survive, then they either shouldn't be operating or it's all on them, that sort of thing, which I don't know if we would still say for a small private business. I mean, because nowadays the math doesn't math for for-profit businesses either.
Well, this is where nonprofits occupy a unique space, and I think not necessarily to the benefit of the whole. If I dream of opening a dry cleaners and I open a dry cleaners, the market is going to dictate whether or not I'm going to be successful. And maybe as I struggle, I can, you know, take out loans and I can keep pouring money into it. But at some point, you know, it's going to collapse. I just wasn't good enough at running a dry cleaner for whatever reason.
Back to selling shoes.
Nonprofits can struggle and sort of keep going because they can fundraise. And so I think sometimes we don't look for better options and opportunities because we're not forced to. So a topic that is really starting to take off in the nonprofit sector right now is mergers. And the Nonprofit Association of Oregon is doing a lot of good work helping to facilitate this conversation. A couple of years ago, if you uttered the word merger in a room full of nonprofits, it was akin to shouting fire in a crowded theater.
I was just going to say they love the word consolidation,
right?
Because it has a better connotation,
right? Because the struggle is real right now in terms of funding and how finite the resources are, For the first time, I mean, nonprofits are really thinking about consolidation, thinking about mergers, thinking about ways to survive. Look, you know, there's a lot of news this week about the partnership between Willamette University and Pacific. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the headline is it's a merger. I read the article and it looks more like what you would call a consortium. And you see these kinds of consortiums in higher education. I don't know anything about Willamette and Pacific. I don't have any insight or inside information. But having worked in education and having worked in higher education, small liberal arts colleges are closing all the time. We've had some close in our own community. It's unthinkable to people who, you know, are alumni. Can you ever imagine your university, you know, not existing? It happens all the time because in the end, it's math. You know, you've got to have, you know, the enrollment and the revenue in order to sustain what is an increasingly expensive and competitive landscape. So I look at what Willamette and Pacific are doing, and I'm like, well, this seems very clever. Mm-hmm. This seems like a way for them to join forces and strengthen themselves and not fall victim to what's happening to small colleges like them across the country every single week. And for whatever reason, in the nonprofit sector, we don't naturally gravitate to those kinds of solutions. Yes, number one, it feels like an erasure. And I'm sure that there are, you know, alumni and staff and communities at these two colleges that are probably really upset about this. But they're not nearly as upset as they would be if tomorrow their college no longer existed. And that's the stark reality in mm-hmm. higher education. And I think that's also the reality in the nonprofit sector. Mm-hmm. And so I applaud, you know, NAO and others. Libra Ford in our community was the first to sort of kick this off with an op-ed about, you know, hey, nonprofits, wake up. You know, it might be time to think about consolidation, to think about merging, to think about ways to join your mission with another organization and be stronger for it and sustain yourselves so that you're still going to be there in the future when the community continues to need you.
And I think that people think that it's like a one or the other. Like I can say nonprofits should exist and they need our support. I can also say that a nonprofit shouldn't be formed or it should do 5 programs and not 10 programs. You know, we live in a time of like this or that. There's a lot of binary thinking. And I think that's why the conversation, like with NAO and some other folks, it's narrowing or redefining purpose. It's consolidating or it's dissolving. And if you dissolve, it's done in a respectful manner as well. It's not stay open and struggle or dissolve. There's a whole spectrum, just like in laws, you know, it's a lot of times conflict and then litigation. There's a whole spectrum of problem solving. Like the community needs to focus on abundance and sharing resources. So you mentioned the schools. I know we also talked about, I think we both are from California, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you talk about the Claremont colleges. So can you just explain for listeners the concept of a consortium model and what that would look like and how that would not solve all the problems, but would make things better both now and in the future?
Yeah, you know, the reason why, if you start talking about mergers in a room full of nonprofits, you clear the room pretty quickly, is that, you know, mergers by and large are acquisitions. You know, one entity acquires another entity. And there is some erasure that's involved in that. There is, you are taking two separate entities, perhaps, and you are combining them into one. Mm-hmm. And so that is a change in terms of community and culture. And for people, you know, who are doing this work and feel so passionately about their mission and their values and their legacy, that's a really appalling idea. What a consortium could do is actually help, you can maintain your independence, but you form a partnership, a more substantive official partnership, where you can share things like back office supports. You can create an ecosystem. So in the college environment, and so one of the more successful consortiums in higher education is the Claremont College. It's in Southern California, in sort of the east part of Los Angeles. It's 5 to 7 universities, depending on how you count them. All really excellent, prestigious, expensive liberal arts universities and colleges, each with kind of their own niche. Just because you want to go to Claremont McKenna or Pomona doesn't mean that you'd want to go to Scripps or Harvey Mudd. But what they did by joining together is they have, I believe, the third largest university library system in the state of California. Now, that's not something that they could have done on their own, of course, to rival, you know, a UC Berkeley or a Stanford or a UCLA. But together they could. They could offer their students exceptional student health, campus security, better facilities, because they're all sharing these facilities. So there's some economy of scale. You are creating an ecosystem where if you go to Harvey Mudd, you can enjoy all the things that attracted you to go to Harvey Mudd, you know, small class sizes, get to really know your professors, that sort of a small college environment. But you can also take part in big campus opportunities because the consortium of 5 or 7 is larger than the single entity. And I would imagine if you were, let's say, in the history department at Pomona, and maybe you really love teaching history at Pomona because you have small class sizes and you get to really develop you know, wonderful relationships with your students and really serve your passion as a history professor. But maybe you miss that larger scholarly community as well. And I would imagine then they get that because the ecosystem is larger. They can match up with the history departments at the other consortium members. And so when I talk about a consortium, what I tell people is that you still get to be your nonprofit. You know, for the most part, what's happening inside your walls in your day to day aren't going to feel any different. But you're going to be a part of something greater. And how is that going to benefit you? Well, you know, we're going to go to market and maybe we'll be able to get better health benefits. Because instead of trying to get benefits for, you know, 30 employees, you know, the consortium has, you know, hundreds of employees altogether. We can get better rates on insurance. We can get leverage some IT and cybersecurity support that is really hard for small and medium-sized nonprofits to fund themselves, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That you can, you know, the reason the Claremont Consortium started 100 years ago was the president of Pomona sort of looked into the future and said, look, we either grow and then we're no longer what we want to be, what we were founded to be, or we stay what we are, we stay true to ourselves, but we're going to lose out on the students of the future who are going to have greater expectations, who are going to want more than we can offer. So how do we offer the best of both worlds? How do we offer that small college experience that will draw people to Pomona, but also provide big campus experiences that students in the future are going to want? And so that was truly visionary, and I think has proven to be successful. And there are examples like this, you know, all across the country. I used to live in Western Massachusetts, and so you have the wonderful colleges up in Northampton and Amherst who really do have that kind of coalition and consortium. It's different than the Claremont, but students can take classes at the different universities and can participate in programs at the different colleges and universities. And even then, they're still struggling, you know. And I think the survival, it really requires people to think outside the box and think about different structures and systems.
If you were to tell people in office now, you know, kind of a message about the state of nonprofits and what we should be thinking about, like, what is that message?
I'm going to go back to what you were talking about earlier, and I would ask to find some way to stand up technical assistance for nonprofits. I think the understanding that it's going to be very difficult for nonprofits to provide the level of internal expertise and knowledge that they need. They just don't have the funding to do that. And the funding they have, you know, is really directed at the services that they're trying to provide. And there's not a lot of excess funding to spend on things like IT and cybersecurity and finance departments and human resources and et cetera. So if our public officials believe that nonprofits will remain essential to the public good, mm-hmm. right, that they are an important partner to our civic bodies and agencies, then I think using that expertise that exists within the public frame and find ways to provide that expertise so it's accessible to nonprofits. And that's going to take funding.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've reached the part of the podcast where we play a game.
Great.
it's called Why Is It Like This? So my why is it like this today, and it can be about this or something mm-hmm. else, but mine is about sales. So, you know, you go to a clothing store and it says that it's first of all, you don't always see that it says up to. You see 70% off or 60%. You have to look really closely for the up to. Mm-hmm. But then you walk in and you go to the store and you see that maybe three things are 70% off. Everything else is 10% off, 20% off. My grievance with that is there shouldn't be a sign that says up to 70% if it's just a few things.
Right. The buyer beware, right?
Yeah. So what about you? What's yours? What's your, why is it like this?
Okay. So because this just happened to me, earlier this week. My favorite candy is our, Swedish Fish. I remember as a kid going to the Sears candy store. Right. Back when there were Sears and back when Sears had a candy store and you could get in the Swedish Fish were the best. So I was standing in line and, you know, sometimes they have the candy, you know, sort of while you're waiting in line, you know, on the shelves. And so it was an impulse buy. I saw the box of Swedish Fish and I'm like, I'm going to treat myself to this. And it was a pretty good size box. And now you can imagine what happened when I actually opened the box. And it was probably a third full. And then what they do is they actually, the Swedish Fish are inside a plastic wrap inside the cardboard box. And I guess that helps make it feel heavier. You can't like rattle it around to actually realize that it's this big empty box with about seven, you know, pieces of candy in it. I mean, it's just, you know, it's not that it's just, it's wasteful. Right. Yeah. But it's, boy, it's how disappointing, yeah. You know, it's like buying the ice cream cone and having it sort of fall off and hit the sidewalk. That's the feeling I got. Yeah. And I'm like, that's just not right.
It was like a bait and switch, no pun intended, because it's
yes,
the fish.
Yes, yes. I see what you did there. That's very clever. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being such a great community leader and for all the work you've done. And thanks for doing this podcast today.
Oh, thank you for all the support that you give to nonprofits. You give a lot of your time and expertise, and it's so meaningful to a lot of nonprofits out there. So thank you.
Thanks so much, Kyle. Well, we've reached the end of this episode of All American Why. If you you made it this far, congratulations. You're officially an excessive thinker too. If something today made you laugh, cringe, or reconsider everything you thought you understood about this country, good. That's the point. Subscribe, rate, review, and share All American Why wherever you get your podcasts, including on YouTube. Or don't. It's still a free country for now. You can find me, Michael Jonas, on social media or at allamericanwhy.com, where we're building community for people who still give a damn. Original music by Renezra and Views. Audio editing by Kyle Gilmore of Residual Audio. Until next time, keep your curiosity loud, your optimism spiteful, and your democracy under constant surveillance. This is All American Why. Thank you for listening.
All American Why. All American Why. Ask yourself the American Why.
Nailed it? Do it again, or is it good? Okay.